On the telephone line right here, you're listening to WCSB Cleveland, Vince Guerrieri. Vince, how you doing?
Good. How about you?
Well, Vince, I apologize for the technical difficulties here at WCSB, but we are back to normal. And Vince is you write for the Elyria Chronicle-Telegram, and that's quite a newspaper.
Well, I should. I don't do a lot of writing for them. I'm an office jockey. I'm one of the guys that kind of keep things, you know, humming as best I can.
Oh, well, I mean, that's good that you're able to do that. And you attended Bowling Green State University, home of the Falcons, and you have three books on Ohio sports history, which I'm a huge, huge fan of sports history. And we're going to get into all that in your latest book, if I have it right in front of me, because it's a very good book. It's titled Weird Moments in Cleveland Sports. So how long did this one take you to write?
This was actually my pandemic project. It was one of those things that kind of, you know, took on a life of its own after a conversation on Twitter, and this would have been right before everything hit in early 2020, and then all of a sudden there was no sports to watch, and I had free time on my hands, and I'm going, I can probably do something with this. So I turned in the manuscript in March, although, you know, it wasn't that hard of a deadline because the publishing industry, like everybody else, has had problems with supply chain issues and you know, things like that. But we were able to get it printed, and it got loose last month.
Mm. The stories, Vince, that are in this book, many of them I do remember. And the one, the 10-cent beer night, which, you know, there is a lot to that because that wasn't the only 10-cent beer night. There were others, and other cities had them, and they went fine. But on June 4th, 1974, against the Texas Rangers, things did not go well. And there was probably a number of reasons, including not enough police officers on hand. So maybe give the audience a little bit of insight on, you know, your view of things.
Well, you're absolutely right. This was a fairly common promotion, not just in Cleveland, but at a bunch of ballparks. This was actually supposed to be the first of four, and they did a second one after this one, but they learned from their mistakes, and I believe the story from the Cleveland Press the next day said, you know, it was so calm that you could actually hear the foam bubbles in people's beer cups. But what had happened was they were playing the Rangers, and it was they had actually played the Rangers a week earlier, and there was a little bit of bad blood. And you know, this was one of those crowds because, and I talked to some people who were at the game. I'm actually working on something for the 50th anniversary, but I talked to some people who were at the game, and they said it was a really big crowd, and it was a really big crowd of people that, you know, we didn't recognize as the baseball regulars,
right?
Who weren't there to see the ball game. I mean, Tim Russert was a student at
John Carroll
at the
right.
time, and he said, yeah, I went to the stadium with $2, and you can do the math from there. But, I mean, it was just, you know, it was a rowdy crowd. I know there were some people who were there who said, yeah, I felt like I could get a contact buzz. And they were mostly harmless. You know, they were jumping down, running across the field, things like that. But what happened was in the bottom of the ninth inning, and the Indians were coming back. They were on the verge of winning this game.
Yeah.
You know, somebody jumped down, ran over, tried to take Jeff Burrow's hat.
In right field, yeah.
In right field, and Burrow fell over. And the field was crowned, and the dugout was below field level. So, you know, they see this guy running toward him, and they see, you know, Jeff Burrow all of a sudden fall down, and they think, you know, oh, my God, there's a fight going on in right field. Then the manager of the Rangers at the time was Billy Martin, who never met a fight he didn't like. So he says, come on, we got to go out and get him. And then, you know, the Indians realized what was going on. They said, we got to go help him. And, you know, that was the point that all hell broke loose. You know, there were you know, fights. There were people throwing things from the
Oh, it was terrible. I saw the video of it. Joe Tate went insane on the air. And I believe there were 26,000 people. And the reason they had these promotions, Vince, you can correct me if I'm wrong, is that the Indians did not draw anything. They hadn't drawn a million people in a long, long time, and they needed anything to get people in the gates.
They had actually, the last time they had drawn a million fans before 1974. 1974 was actually a fairly good year for the Indians. I mean, they were, you know, it was really the only year that they were really competitive, you know, between the 50s and once they moved into Jacobs Field in the 90s. But, you know, yeah, that's, I mean, the Indians were always hanging on by their fingernails, staying in Cleveland in the late 50s and the early 60s, you know. Any city that was looking for a team at one point had conversations with Cleveland. There was a very public flirtation with Seattle in the 1960s. And in fact, Nick Mulledy had just bought the team prior to 1974, and he bought it from Vern Stopher, which is another story that in a roundabout way makes it into the book. And he, one of the things that Stopher had done is he says, we're going to have, you know, we're going to play a limited number of home games, and you can't see it right now, but I'm making air quotes. But he says, we're going to play home games in New Orleans once they build the new dome there. And I mean, it was definitely a very difficult go of it to kind of keep the lights on at Cleveland Stadium.
Right.
So, you know, they did all kinds of promotions. They had all kinds of giveaways. I actually got to talk to Dick Bosman about his no hitter, which was also in that 1974 season. And one of the things he told me, he said, I was really disappointed because I had to do all these interviews and I had to miss the King and His Court, which was a semi-pro softball team that would play,
and they were
playing at the ballpark that night. So they would have all kinds of promotions, and obviously some of them work better than others.
Well, that's true. You know, looking down that roster, they didn't have a bad roster. They had Dave Duncan was a catcher and later a pitching coach for the Oakland A's. George Hendrick, Charlie Spikes, Oscar Gamble. Rusty Torres, I remember him very well. And the pitching staff, Gaylord Perry, we traded Sam McDowell to get Gaylord and Frank Duffy, Gaylord, you know, RIP. Jim Perry, his brother, was on a team. Fritz Peterson, you mentioned Dick Bosman. And, of course, how about in the bullpen, Tom Buskey?
And Peterson, I believe, actually got the start the night of 10 Cent Beer Night. But, no, it was not a bad team. And, you know, Vernon, I mentioned Vernon Stopher. He actually tried to sell the Indians to George Steinbrenner, but that deal fell apart a variety of reasons. That's in the book, too.
Yeah.
But Steinbrenner later said, you know, when I bought the Yankees in 73,
yeah.
I mean, the Indians had more talent than the Yankees did when I bought them. So, I mean, it was not a bad team. It was just one of those instances where, you know, there were a lot of people who had to come and go.
Right. The Indians would have been, I think, a serious contender for a long time had they had the financial backing. They just did not have that. And then when Steinbrenner went to New York, he put the Yankees on the map, but it took a few years for him to do that. So it wasn't until 1977 that they actually won their first World Series since 1964, if I'm not mistaken.
That is correct. But, you know, the other thing, too, is I mean, up until I don't think it's coincidence that, you know, Steinbrenner started doing that once free agency was a thing. Because, I mean, you know, prior to that, baseball was governed by the reserve clause. And
right.
Nobody could, you know, you were essentially bound to a team whether you were under contract to them or not. And that really kind of kept player salaries down.
Oh, it did. And the designated hitter rule also was a nice added touch for the American League to get some more offense in the game. That was in 1973. And I think Ron Bloomberg was the first designated hitter to take an at-bat.
That is correct.
Yeah, I remember that. I had a very lonely childhood, so I used to memorize all this crazy stuff. And let's speak about crazy things. Vince, what about the wrong way basket? Johnny Warren. The Cavs' first season was in 1970-71, a memorable one for all the wrong reasons. The team began its existence with 15 straight losses, and their first win was against the New York Knicks. So let's talk about the early days of the Cleveland Cavaliers.
Sure, sure. And it's really funny that you bring up the wrong way basket because, I mean, if you are of a certain age, if you're my age, give or take, when somebody says, oh, yeah, Cavs player who shot a wrong way basket, you automatically say Ricky Davis. And a lot of people have said that to me.
Yeah, he tried to get the triple-double, right?
He was the second one. But the first one, and I believe it was the start of the I can't remember if it was the start of third quarter or the start of the fourth quarter, but there was a jump ball. And the Cavs pulled it down. They were playing the Trailblazers, who were also an expansion team that year.
That's right.
And the Cavs pulled it down, and you know, it was a, you know, I got to talk to the late Bill Fitch about this for a story I wrote for Ohio Magazine. And he says, oh, my God, it was great. It was, you know, they just threaded a perfect pass to John Warren. Warren puts up the shot, 2 points, and everything worked like they thought it was supposed to. And then the whistle blows, and I can't remember if it was Fitch or if it was Warren who told me. They said, I was legitimately worried that there was going to be a traveling call until they realized that they were headed toward the wrong basket. And, you know, it's a penalty if you shoot at the wrong basket.
Sure it is, yeah. Wow, that's just, that's unbelievable. You kind of lose sight. Oh, my God, what did I just do? And it was like Jim Marshall running the wrong way for the touchdown when he did it for Minnesota against Detroit back in 1970.
Yeah, it's very easy to get turned around over things like that.
Yeah, you just get so wrapped up in the game. Oh, my God, we're at the wrong basket. It's crazy stuff. And the Cavaliers had quite you know, Vince, tell me if I'm wrong in this one. Bob Rule played with the Cavaliers, I think, in the second season. And there was a bar across the street from the old Cleveland Arena, which isn't far from our studio here at WCSB. He went in the bar with his warm-up on and had a drink before the game. I heard that story from Les Levine.
I mean, if Les said it, then it's got to be true, right?
Yeah.
But I don't know that one, but that's the kind of thing that is just absolutely not even a little bit surprising.
No, no. And speaking of surprising or not surprising, Julio Franco goes MIA on April 19th, 1985, when the Indians were doing a series in the Bronx against the Yanks. And let's talk about that one for a minute.
Sure, sure. That's, you know, again, like I said, the 80s were kind of a, well, really the 70s and the 80s and most of the 60s were kind of a fallow period for the Indians. But they were able to pull together some real talent. And Julio Franco was one of the guys that came over in that Vaughn Hayes trade. And they were playing a three-game series in the Bronx. And you know, this was the point where everybody was scared of the Bronx. And, I mean, it's not that far after. You talked about that 1977 World Series. That was the one where Howard Cosell looked out and said, ladies and gentlemen, the Bronx is burning, which obviously became the title of a book and I thought a fairly well-done ESPN miniseries as well.
Yeah, I did see that. And the Bronx was a dangerous place back then.
But Julio Franco plays a game, has a pretty good game, and then kind of falls off the face of the earth. I mean, they couldn't find him, and that's, you know, worrisome to say the least. But eventually they found him, and the team did not put out an official statement, but, you know, it really sounded like he went to, it sounded like he had a good time. That's probably the best way to put it. And he went to a friend's house, and the friend didn't have a telephone. And, you know, he was just kind of out of touch for a little while. So they find him, put him back in the lineup, you know, I mean, he still continued to hit for the Indians that weekend.
Yeah, Pat Corrales was manager. And that was Pat was a pretty good manager for that team for that short period of time that he was here.
Well, I think the problem is that, you know, there was a lot of things that, you know, he could only be asked so much. Actually, all of those Indians managers, you know, Pat Corrales and Dave Garcia and Doc Edwards, I mean, you know, there was only so much that they could do with the, you know, with the cast on hand.
Yeah, well, that's true. You can't make a silk purse out of a sow's ear, and they did the best they could. Vince Guerrero, his latest book, Weird Moments in Cleveland Sports, Gray & Company Publishers. We want to thank David Gray for all his help. Vince, was this fun for you to write? It seems like it was.
Mostly. I mean, there were some things that I revisited that were, like, you know, I don't want to say traumatic, but, I mean, they were definitely, you know, brought back, you know, me watching all of these stupid things happening in real time because... and some of those were things that I really didn't, you know, wasn't sure that I wanted to revisit again.
Such as?
The Dwayne Rudd game comes immediately to mind. You know, the opener against the Kansas City Chiefs in
2002. Yeah.
Yes. And how, you know, there's a what he thought was the last play of the game. He sacks the quarterback and he gets up. And he saw the clock hit zero, so the game's over, and he throws his helmet. And as it turns out, the quarterback was able to get the ball off in time. So, you know, there was still, you know, the game wasn't over when he took his helmet off.
No.
And so he got flagged, and as Browns fans know, the game can't end on a defensive penalty. The Browns, since that was the first of three games that the Browns have lost since then, on an untimed final play, which is one of those things that just kind of boggles my mind. So obviously, you know, with the yardage that they had gained from the play and with the penalty yardage, it set up a chip shot field goal, which the Chiefs made and won the game.
Yeah, I mean, that maybe was an omen and, you know, the shades and shapes of things to come for Cleveland. And what were your thoughts going into the 1999 season? I mean, did you feel good about the team and the franchise, or did you think that they should have changed the name and colors completely and or maybe not come back at all?
I feel like knowing then what I know now, if I had known what was going to unfold over the next 20 years, I would have said, yeah, that's, you know, I mean, now's a good time. It should be a different team or you know, put a pin in it entirely. But at the time, I mean, you know, we had just seen expansion teams make it to their respective conference championships within two years of their expansion year in Jacksonville, Carolina. So, I mean, there was no reason to believe that things would go as badly as they would.
I agree with you. My father at the time, we talked about this. He says, well, they should change the name and the colors. I said, no, let's keep the colors and everything. Now looking back on it, he was right. They should have called the team something different. And looking at the Browns, when you hear the Browns, I think of the 1960s, 70s, and 80s Browns. That's what I remember. But this incarnation of the Browns since 1999 is just a complete disaster. And we have a disaster in the ownership now. The team, no matter what the team does, it seems like it's always overshadowed by something else.
Well, and it's really funny because, I mean, we talked about 10-cent beer night, among other things. But, I mean, the Indians appeared to be, in the 70s and the 80s, the leader in the clubhouse for the team that had the most goofy stuff going on. But, I mean, since they've come back, the Browns have just been the gift that keeps on giving.
Yeah, I mean, 32 starting quarterbacks. I mean, and they had some talent, for goodness sakes. They could have just put some protection around Tim Couch in that first year. He would have been, I think, a very good serviceable starting quarterback. He would have been fine. And now, even now, you know, what are they going to do with Deshaun Watson? The baggage is, he's got like an airport full of baggage with him, and I don't even want to get into that. So, I don't know. It's crazy. Could you share with us, Vince, some of the great stories of the Indian, like Albert Bell in the Cleveland Indians clubhouse?
I was told that he was, I wasn't told. I mean, I read this, but eventually he had the nickname Mr. Freeze.
Yeah.
Because I guess he liked the thermostat at a certain number, and he was kind of alone in that respect, to the point where he would change the thermostat, and then one of his teammates would change the thermostat, and then he'd change it back, and one of his teammates would change it back. And finally, Albert Bell came in and just smashed it all to hell with a baseball bat.
Yeah. That's
I was
so
told
Albert.
That he did the same thing to a teammate's boombox as well.
That is so Albert, and he. But you know, he had that. He was I think the word is enigma. He really was that guy. But when he was on the field, I think he was one of the best hitters that we had in the last 40 years.
He was amazing, and you know, he was just up for one of the veterans committee elections for the Hall of Fame. Didn't get in. Fred McGriff got in. They announced it yesterday. Sunday, excuse me.
Yeah.
But I always felt that Albert Bell, you could make a case for him, but I felt like he had too short of a prime. But, man, in that prime, he was dangerous. I mean, he was just... And I can remember going to those games in the mid-90s, and it seemed like no lead was safe for the Indians, and Albert Bell was a big reason for that. I mean, he hit for power, he hit for average. And still, 95, he had 50 home runs and 50 doubles in a shortened season. That was a 144-game season. And that had never been done before,
right,
and it has never been done since.
Yeah, exactly right. And Albert Bell was something else. And he was a above-average outfielder. And he just had... I remember the home run that he hit off Troy Percival. He was with the Angels at that time. And Percival was a really top relief pitcher in the American League. And Bell just... he just dominated him. And he, I don't know. He had something that... He was afraid of nothing. The man was afraid of absolutely nothing. Courage beyond belief.
And unfortunately, you know, that sometimes bled over into folly, you know, like when kids were egging his house or when he felt like, you know, picking a fight with, you know, somebody in the media.
Vince, what about the most difficult story in this book for you to write? What was that story?
Really sure about that. I mean, like I said, you know, there are certain things that were just kind of unpleasant to revisit. Like, you know, I wrote about the Duane Rudd helmet toss, and that was one of those things where he went, you know, I mean, oh, if that had turned out differently. You see, there are certain things that you write about, and you see a ripple effect that goes absolutely sideways. Like the Fausto Carmona story I wrote about his change in identity.
Roberto Hernandez.
I think is the best diplomatic way to put it. But, you know, that kind of leads me to revisit the 2007 season and the 2007 postseason. That's the one that was, you know, I thought like they had the... I shouldn't say I thought that they had it in the bag against the Red Sox, but I feel like they were in a pretty good spot to take that series. If they had taken that series, I really believe they would have won the World Series against the Rockies that year. But, you know, I wrote about Butch Davis, and you know, you revisit that 2003 playoff game, and it was one of those games where I can remember watching it and just being overjoyed at halftime, and then, you know, by the end of the game, I was yelling and throwing things at the television with my grandmother.
Yeah.
And you know, you revisit things like this, and it's really unpleasant. And then what's really funny is after the 2020 season, I'm watching the playoff game against the Steelers, and I'm thinking at halftime, I'm as happy now as I was at halftime of that 2003 playoff game. And somebody said to me, how big a lead do the Browns have for you to feel comfortable? And I said triple digits.
Yeah, that's good. I like that. Yeah, the Cleveland Browns. I was at the game, the drive. I'm sure you were there as well. And I'm sitting.
I watched that one on TV, but yeah.
Here's what I thought, and I want to hear what you thought. I'm watching the game. I'm in the dog pound right now, and I'm freezing my you know what off. It is horribly cold, and I'm thinking, boy, this is all going to be worth it if they make the Super Bowl. And I think, boy, they got this game. And then all of a sudden, I see Elway get out of one. He's able to get out of one tackle. He gets out of another. He throws for a completion. I'm thinking, they can't stop this guy. There's no way they're going to win this game. And that's what I'm thinking in the back of my mind. Nobody could step up and make a play. I don't understand that. You know, and did you think the same thing watching on TV?
I mean, this is another one of those really good examples of something that you see ripple on through years. I mean, I can remember watching, you know, how many of those balls did he throw that were just
missed,
you know, absolutely on target. I mean, you know, less than an inch one way or the other, and it's, you know, I think the Browns close it out. Or, you know, how many of those tackles did he just elude too? And I really feel like that was one of those games that had a lot more impact than a lot of people realize, because Art Modell obviously said he had no choice to move to Baltimore, and I feel like if the Browns go to a Super Bowl, not even win a Super Bowl, just go to a Super Bowl in that era, a deal gets done, there's a new stadium, and you know, all of what we've seen over the last 20 odd years from this team masquerading as the Browns never happens.
You know, Vince, I think you're right. I really do. I think they win that game or the one in Denver the following year, which earned the fumble by Ernest Biner, who, by the way, had a tremendous year, and I can't blame him for that. It was a fumble, but still, I think without him, we would not have been in that position anyway. But the 86, the drive, he throws, I remember Elway threw a ball. Carl Hairston just missed tipping that ball. He tips that ball, it's a whole different story. You know, that was, and nobody could make a play. It's like, I mean,
they converted on what, 4th and 18 at that point?
They did, yeah. They did it. And then Rich Carlos kicked that ball. I didn't think it went through. But.
And you are hardly alone in that sentiment.
How could they not check that? I mean, everybody, I'm sitting there and I'm looking at the ball and I'm thinking, God, he missed that. I don't know how they counted it, but you go back and watch it, or was it, I don't know, you saw it on TV, though.
I did, and you know, it was one of those things that, you know, I'm not sure how. I don't think I was that rooted to it at that point, because I think I knew what was coming. I mean, even at that age, I would have been I'm not even 10 years old, but it would have been. I knew what was going to happen.
You felt it. Yeah, I felt it. You felt it. I think everybody felt it.
I mean, there are certain games that you feel good about when you have a lead. There are certain games that you feel bad about even if you have a lead. And this was one of those games where, you know, you just start seeing things snowball.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and at the end of that game, and not only was it below zero, and you're beaten down mentally, you have to walk out and you couldn't hear a pin drop. I mean, it was terrible. It was an awful, awful feeling that I never wanted to feel again as a fan. And I think that was one of the beginning of the end for me, you know, following sports teams and letting my emotions get up and down. Because when you do that and you lose a game, it affects you too much. And I don't want that to ever happen again.
Yeah. I mean, at the end of the day, being a sports fan is supposed to be fun, and that was one of the things that I had in mind when I wrote this book, is the idea that, you know, I mean, there has to be some sort of you know, shared, if not shared joy, then at least shared amusement.
Right. Yeah, it's right. Amusement, indeed. Were you a hockey fan, Vince, growing up at all?
You know, it's really funny. I was never a hockey fan growing up, but then I went to Bowling Green, and we lived right across the street from the ice arena, and then we'd spend, you know, weekends there watching the games. And then my first job as a reporter was in Pittsburgh, and the Penguins at that point were good, but not like really, really good, so tickets were still fairly easy to come by. So I would go to a lot of Penguins games, and boy, I'll tell you what, there is nothing like watching hockey in person.
No, there isn't. Hockey's an incredible game, and the Penguins. Now, what years were you following them?
This would have been when I was living there in the early aughts. So Mario had just come back for a little bit, and like I said, they were a good team, but they were not, you know, really good. The tickets were hard to come by.
Mm. Yeah, watching Lemieux, I think Lemieux was my favorite player. He was a big, big man. He could do it all. Strong, great skater, great leader. And Gretzky was a great player, no question. But Mario was just big and strong. And I think that he had every attribute you'd ever want as a hockey player, I think.
He just couldn't stay healthy.
No, I know. That was a shame. But he had a great career nonetheless. And then Jaromir Jagr played with him as well. And Jagr, God, he played for like 24 years. I mean, he was a
genius. Jagr's like Julio Franco. He's probably still playing somewhere.
I think if I read somewhere, he's back in Czechoslovakia playing. The guy's like 50 years old now, and he's still playing professional hockey somewhere. I mean, you have to be in one tremendous specimen to be able to play at that level at that age, you know. And
I mean, you have to be pretty well off to play at any level at that age.
That's very true.
I mean, don't forget, you're on skates, and I can barely walk and chew gum.
I still play a little hockey, but it's as I'm getting older now, it's just the day after is always, my gosh, I feel it in my back and everything. And when you're 25 years old, you can just bounce back like it's nothing.
Mm-hmm.
That's the problem with being old. All right, Vince, I'm gonna ask you one more story because I wanted people to buy the book. It's a wonderful book, Weird Moments in Cleveland Sports, and Vince Guerrieri is the author. And you can get the book anywhere, put out by Cleveland's own Gray and Company Publishing. Ted Stepien. A lot has been written about Ted. Ted has got a terrible reputation, but I want you to, if you could share with us some wonderful stories of Ted.
Well, he was, you know, he was another one of those guys who was, you know, successful in one facet. He built up an advertising company from pretty much nothing. Ended up in Cleveland to go to school on the GI Bill. And so, you know, he started throwing some money around. He was a minority owner in the Indians in the early 70s, and eventually he bought the Cavaliers, and it was, you know, one of those jobs that he was, well, let's diplomatically say, not perfectly suited for. Is that a good way to put it?
I think that would be perfect, because that would be probably an understatement.
Honestly, I see a lot of him in Haslam too, because he's one of those guys who was successful in one facet of life and felt like that would translate into success in another facet of life, and it didn't. And he made, you know, very. He was very quick on the draw. At one point, in one calendar year, he had four different coaches for the Cavaliers. And he was more than willing to deal draft picks for players, not just players, but bad players. But Dick Motta in Dallas said, "I'm afraid to leave my desk to go to the bathroom because I'm afraid Cleveland will call."
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, it got so bad first that the NBA said, "We are going to approve. We have to approve every deal you make." And then, you know, it got to the point where they actually put a rule in place that a team can't trade back-to-back first-round picks.
The Stepien rule.
The Stepien rule, yes. And he ended up selling the team to the Gunn brothers. You asked me about hockey. They were actually minority owners of the
Barons.
Cleveland Barons in the NHL. And were probably one of the reasons that the team ended up making the move from the Bay Area to Cleveland. But, you know, when they bought the Cavs from Ted Stepien, they had to buy draft picks from the league.
Yeah, yeah, it was just unbelievable. And they fired Joe Tate, the greatest broadcaster ever, and nobody went to the games, and they went. Chuck Daly started here in Cleveland. Bill Laimbeer played with the Cavaliers. It was just unbelievable.
Yeah, Stepien fired Joe Tate in a fit of pique. He also actually switched radio broadcasters for the Cavaliers for the same reason, because he felt like, you know, he was getting undue criticism from the radio station, and I'm sure he was getting criticism. I'm not sure that I'd call it undue.
No, Pete Franklin used to really ride him hard, and justifiably so. I mean, he. You know,
that was one of my favorite stories, that Stepien was actually doing an interview for a radio station in Toronto. The Cavs were a hair away from moving to Toronto, and he was doing a radio interview, and somebody calls in, and it's Pete Franklin, and he says, "Am I talking to the dumbest man in pro sports?" And it just went downhill from there.
Oh, that's so Pete Franklin. I mean... Sweet Pete, they used to call him. He was something else. Vince, I enjoyed it. Are you going to be doing any book signings anywhere?
Yes, I am. You can find all of the events I've got scheduled on the Gray Publishing website, grayco.com. I'll be at the Barnes & Noble in Metter this Saturday. I'll be at the Barnes & Noble in Fairlawn next Saturday. And Friday the 16th, I'll be at Visible Voice in Tremont.
The 16th. All right, I'm going to try to make that one. Vince, it was a pleasure. I hope you enjoyed yourself.
I did.
Thank you for being on the Ray Carr Show, and I wish you the very best, and nice job with the book.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Bye, Vince.